All right, let's get rolling, y'all. I did my master's degree at Mississippi State with Rick Kaminsky, and this was one of the studies we did. It was at Noxby Wildlife Refuge. And they have four green tree reservoirs, really three that are operational. And now they may just manage just these two, GTR 1 and 2. And again, they've been, with Kaminsky being at Mississippi State, they've really done a lot of the research on green tree reservoir management in the southeast and how to effectively do it. And Noxby was noticing a change in tree composition, et cetera, like, you know, hey, what do we do to maintain these systems? So this is Bluff Lake that you can see up there. This is Locofoma Lake here. There's a road that kind of goes in between them, and the visitor center is about right there, and we're staying out on a peninsula out here right in the lake. It's pretty, it's beautiful there. It's a really nice area. And although if it's warm enough, you'll see gators, so if you wander off and, you know, stumble into the down in the marsh, just remember that. If it was later in the year, but it should be, this is a great time of year to be in Mississippi. Yeah. All right, so one of the things that they were looking at is the effect of flooding, even before I got there, on tree composition and et cetera with Young's work. And then what we wanted to look at, and one of the questions that was brought up, was what about seedling survival and overwinter seedling survival? That's what we were interested in looking at. So we, even before I got there, they set this treatment up, this study up, where they have two main green tree reservoirs here that they can flood with water from Bluff Lake. Okay, so water from Bluff Lake, they can basically funnel into Green Tree Reservoir 2 and funnel it then into Green Tree Reservoir, or Green Tree Reservoir 1, then into Green Tree Reservoir 2 through this water control structure that is on, you know, that road that I showed you all earlier with the dynamic hydrology. That road ultimately turns into a levee, and there's your partial levee going around this bottomland system. And then there's another levee that's down here for GTR2. So you can flow water in here. And there's a network of natural dendritic type cypress slough channels so that it kind of flows naturally through here. And you can really, without even flooding GTR1, flow water through here to GTR2 and flood this one up. So that's what they did is for 2 years prior to me getting down there, they basically did not flood GTR1. And they flooded GTR2 continuously, like old school style, right? Where they bring it up, they hold it deep, and they keep it deep there all winter long. And then when I got there, then they reversed the treatments, and they flooded GTR1 continuously, and then just let this, PF means periodically flooded. So from natural overbank flow of the Noxby River, which runs right up like this, so Green Tree Reservoir 1 and 2 get flooded by the Noxby River naturally, okay? So what we did then is I went to Mississippi State in 93, and I went down and I basically during the summer, my first summer there, I went out into these different Green Tree Reservoirs, set up a transect and stuff and some plots, and measured the density and the height of the seedlings that were there for some certain oak species. And so looking really at 2 years of continuous flooding, what was the density and the height, and 2 years of periodically flooding, what was density and the height after 2 years of flooding. Then I basically marked a bunch of seedlings and I followed them for 2 years and looked at how well they survived in continuously flooded areas and in the periodically flooded GTR. Okay, so this was we just had a typical type sampling design. We had plots along a transect, and then we got density by counting in like a belt transect around this plot center, and then we measured height of the nearest species. We did this for three different species. I've got them someplace. Let's see, okay, and then survival, we marked like 9 of the closest seedlings to plot center for each species. Where was the species? Maybe it was on the previous one. So we did this for cherry bark oak, willow oak, and overcup oak. Okay, so our two, you know, decent species for waterfowl and for timber, cherry bark and willow oak, and then overcup oak are our poor species for waterfowl. And percent canopy cover we measured too. I must have had it on the previous one. So anyways, those were the three species. So these were our results after for the 2 years and looking at survival. And so here's willow oak on the left-hand side, cherry bark and overcup oak. And this was survival the following year of this long winter flooding, okay? Again, flooded up basically in November and hold that water, and let the water out in February. And let's look at overwinter seedling survival, okay? And so I went in like July and measured the seedling survival, the ones I had marked with each of those flags. And what you obviously see here going on is the yellow is the periodic and the blue is the continuous, is that there's lower seedling survival in the historic green tree reservoir continuous flooding treatment. And so there wasn't, the first year there wasn't any difference statistically in survival, although it was a little bit higher for overcup oak in the periodically flooded. But even overcup oak, the second year, you can see the big difference at this, following the same individuals. Okay, these are natural seedlings, all right? So these guys are less than a foot tall, and they're just natural regen. And they're getting hammered pretty good. You can see some of this, you know, just within 1 year, around 50% survival. That's not so good, okay? And overall, the continuously flooded was the water was off by the growing season. That's the important thing. We're not flooding into the growing season, but that doesn't mean that those effects can't linger as well as that soil is much more saturated than it normally would with a natural hydrologic regime. Yeah. I didn't have any exclosures, you know, that so they could have, but I didn't notice any herbivory that I recall. Pretty much every, if I couldn't find the seedling, it was thrown out of the analysis. That was the first, but so it was only if I could find it, which would mean basically there was a sprig, there was just a dead stick sitting there, all right? And, you know, if something's been browsed, usually you can tell. And I don't remember any being browsed. Yeah. So this is. Well, yeah, but you would also assume that the mammal, this is a bottomland that is pretty much continuous. So you would assume that herbivory in one GTR would be the same as the other. So as far as the treatment effect is concerned, it should be, if there is a herbivory issue, it should be relatively constant in that bottom. But yeah, good point, good point. Any other questions? So that was the survival thing. Now, we see a little bit different thing here, though, for height. This is kind of an interesting thing. Again, blue, you know, deeper, etc. We have actually a little bit taller seedlings. Not a whole much. This is centimeters, so we're talking maybe an inch taller, okay? Why do you think that might occur? Yeah, and that's the best thing that we could hypothesize, is that the ones that are going to survive are probably your strong survival, the fittest thing going on. You know, your strongest individuals, or so ones that just grew, or even just grew faster and literally got the tap root the apex, thank you, the apex of the stem above, maybe above the water. Or they're just more superior individuals. With density, there's just a ton of variability, and I should have some standard error bars in here. This is occurring here, okay, continuous, oh wow, well hell, there's a lot more, isn't that a good thing? I had a couple plots in here, I should have thrown those out just to look at the analyses again, just to compare, because I had a couple plots that it just happened to land right underneath of a willow oak parent tree, and I got like 1,000 individuals in that one plot, and it really pulled the mean up really high. But At any rate, there weren't any statistical differences in density. So, and it might even be lower for these species. Again, this was an outlier plot, I think, that one that pulled all the other plots up. But regardless, we really can't make any conclusions about density. We see that height might be a little bit higher. Maybe that's differential survival based on the vigor of the seedling. And it's not a whole much, it's like an inch higher. But survival is quite a bit lower. I mean, anywhere between 10 to 30 or 40% lower in the continuously flooded. Again, providing additional evidence that, you know, a lot of the work that had been done had just been done on the mature trees, but what's going on with recruitment? And so this is one of the first studies that did that and looked at that. And so that is one of the, you'll see here, y'all, so the other handouts, this kind of summarizes our at least our survival results. And this, I didn't bring it down, but this is published in a book, just came out in 2005, and it's a great book. And you can get it for like $40 through University of Missouri. And it has some awesome papers on hardwood bottomland systems and green tree reservoir management. And here are a couple other abstracts out from one by Lee Fredrickson and by one of his students, Murray Laubon. Okay. And talking about green tree reservoir management. But just, I put the citation in there so that if y'all are interested in wetlands, these things are going fast, and they won't be around probably much longer. And it'll be one of those texts that'll be, you know, impossible to get. So something to think about because it's a really good text with a lot of good information in there. I will mention. You remember the mentioned thing about Lee Fredrickson, his Green Tree Reservoir Management book. Okay, this is it here. I'll pass it around. Y'all can take a look at it. There's this one, and then there was the other one about, hey, how do you pick a site for a green tree reservoir that him and King wrote, Dr. King. And both of those, both of these are on the website. You can go to the class website, and there's electronic versions of those. So, again, there's a lot of stuff on that website that I encourage you all to, you may want to download just for professional use later on. But, so these were the recommendations that we, I guess this is a summary of our results. Flooding green tree reservoirs periodically during winter may increase seedling survival, but we really can't make a whole lot of conclusions about density and height. So managers, what we recommended is not obviously to flood continuously like historic green tree reservoir management, but to flood periodically, okay, to enhance seedling survival and ensure that recruitment. And even a better thing is to help with recruitment if you have open areas to go in there and do direct seedling plantings. Now, how do you just periodically flood? Well, ultimately, what we're saying is, hey, emulate the natural hydrology, right? But it isn't practical at all for us to emulate the natural hydrology, even if we wanted to do that, okay? Because, you know, flooding these areas, it's a resource. It costs money to move water, et cetera, and you're not going to be able to flood it up, okay, then pull it down, then flood it up again and pull it down, et cetera. Plus, again, we do want to keep these areas flooded so that it does provide predictable habitat for these birds that are coming through. Okay, so it isn't a guessing game. But we need to minimize. So when we say periodically flooded, our recommendation, this is important, is to minimize the duration of flooding. And I am relatively confident that you can put a green tree reservoir pretty much in anywhere and not change the composition for most cases, okay, by really minimizing that flooding. Well, how minimal are we talking about? Well, definitely not flooding for the entire waterfowl hunting season. That is not a good strategy. That is too long. 2 months, 2.5 months, 3 months is too long. In fact, the maximum you should flood a green tree reservoir is 1 month, okay? And that's basically based on the total duration that we found that was happening in these bottomlands for the periodically flooded systems, the naturally flooded systems. It's for about a total of a month these seedlings are, or these bottomlands are being flooded. But we're not going to break that month up like a natural thing where you have a couple days here, 2 weeks here, etc. We're just going to put that month all together so it provides predictable habitat for these birds. Now, most waterfowl hunters are going to say, no, we want it flooded the whole time, but then you're going to run into issues. You're going to run into the problems that we talked about, the negative impacts of green tree reservoirs, okay? So you're really rolling the dice if you go longer than a month. Now, at Noxubee, they have three green tree reservoirs. I think they may just manage two now, but they had three at the time, and this really, and we're talking about 3 months when the birds are primarily there, December, January, and February. So it really provided a unique opportunity to make a recommendation using the 1 month total duration strategy, where basically you sequentially flood and drain one green tree reservoir per month. So what you're doing is you're providing continuously flooded forested habitat just in different locations. Okay? And like all drawdowns, just like we were talking about with moist soil management, we want to bring the water in slow and let the water out slow. Okay? And that does several things. Again, it slowly floods that habitat so that food resources are being continually used as newly flooded habitat gets, a new habitat gets flooded. But then when you let it out, it helps hold those nutrients in that system, which is important for your tree growth, etc. Okay? And it helps consolidate food resources as you bring it down. Okay? The inverts, the acorns, etc. get more consolidated, less the acorns. They tend to get caught up in detritus as they're rolling along the bottom. But at any rate, you will see a lot of times near water control structures, huge aggregations of acorns that have washed down in. But you almost, that should never happen if you're bringing it out down slow, because that is a sign of that somebody pulled all the boards out and let the water come out as fast as they can, okay, as fast as it could. So that is the recommendation. And again, there's a lot of research behind that duration. And that is sometimes the hardest thing in management, is not managing for the animals. It's managing the people that are going to be, the hunters are going to say, no, well, you're going to say you're only going to let this area be hunted for a month? Come on. You know, I mean, we don't have very many hunting opportunities as it is. So there's a lot of education that needs to go on as y'all eventually get out into the field and become biologists, whether it's managing deer or waterfowl or whatever. So that's pretty much, by providing Noxubee this recommendation, they basically provided forested flooded habitat continuously during that part of the annual cycle for the birds, and they minimized flood duration within these reservoirs, which ultimately should result in good seedling recruitment as well as, you know, good acorn production of the mature trees. All right. And they do have their system is awesome. We'll walk down in it, and man, huge cherry bark oaks that, whether you're a wildlife or a forester, will make you drool. I mean, they are just awesome systems down there, and waterfowl use as well. Yeah. Any questions? Oh, this is the other thing about this 1 month thing. Brett, these are two of Kaminsky's other students that were graduating when I just got down there, or really before I got down there. They graduated, I think, 93, I think they graduated. Brett Worley is now, he is going to be with us for a lot of Wednesday's field trip. He is now the waterfowl manager at Noxubee for Fish and Wildlife Service. And Brett studied aquatic inverts, and basically Brett's results showed that aquatic invertebrate biomass was greatest during that first month of flooding. They really explode during that first month of flooding, then you see biomass dropping off. You'll see a change in composition, et cetera, with the environment community as well, but the biomass is the greatest during that first month of flooding. So by flooding just for 1 month, you capitalize off of that initial explosion of invertebrates. Acorn availability is also greatest at that time. I'm not quite sure why. They just must be more available. As things are flooded for longer, they can decompose maybe, or they're just eaten. The acorns are eaten. And then waterfowl use. That's what Sherman actually documented. He did waterfowl studies where he walked transects and counted ducks using these green tree reservoirs, and it was greatest during the first month of flooding. So all these things point towards, the best, you're not stressing your trees, plus there's the most amount of food availability is during that first month, and the research also shows that waterfowl use is greatest during that first month, so there's no reason to be flooding it any longer than a month, all right? And so, depending on your area and how many green tree reservoirs you have, et cetera, often it's only one. You'll just have to kind of compromise. And what I would suggest is, again, no longer than a month, but if you have only one reservoir, let that water start draining it at a month, at 4 weeks, okay? And ideally, this would be the case, is where you would flood it up for about a one to two week period, okay? And then once you hit that, maybe it's stable for a week, and then you start drawing it down for a 1 to 2 week period, okay? Where you're basically ending anywhere between 4 and 6 weeks total that you're holding water on there. Yeah?
This isn't related to GTR. Does that whirly guy have anything to do with the whirly salamander?
No.
You really don't see that spelling.
I don't think. You'll have to ask him. But I don't think so. I mean, it may be a father or relative or something like that, yeah.
So what's the depth that you want to flood to?
Great question. What's the depth you want to flood to? Well, most of these bottom lands, what you're talking about doing is probably flooding. We don't want it for waterfowl. We want it basically 2 feet and less. But this is the problem. Just flooding the 1 or 2 foot contour may not be a whole lot of habitat. Often they flood, even at Noxubee, they flood to the 3 foot contour. You could even think of your contours again in weeks. Flood 1 foot contour the first week, then go up, then hold it there, go up the second 1 foot contour, then the third 1 foot contour, and then bring it back down. So once you're flooded 3 feet, you have 3 feet of water on your lowest end, it's just flooded up at the higher end, and then you bring that water back down slowly. So I wouldn't flood any more than a meter. And of course that can create issues too with duck hunters who want to, motor their boats or whatever. So the bottom line is, if you flood it deep, the birds aren't going to get to it. They forage in areas that, and they prefer even loafing in areas that are not really, really deep. Okay? So, any other questions? Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, now managing forest openings, what are you all going to do? Basically, the bottom line with managing forest openings is we want to create areas for our birds to come in, land, and take advantage of the cover resources, the food resources, etc. The openings can work in concert with regeneration and managing tree composition. So what we're talking about doing is making either small selective cuts or small little clear cuts going into areas to make an opening. And As I mentioned before, we want openings that are over an acre in size. About an acre in size is great. And these can function as areas where you also manage moist soil here, just naturally through hydrology. Or you could just keep it as moist soil and disc it every so often. Or they could be regeneration spots, okay, where you're going in there and planting seedlings and it's only an opening for, you know, 10 years or so. So these areas, I guess I just managed, can be managed for moist soil plants as well as red oak regeneration sites. And what are the species that you want to plant? What are our most ideal species? Cherry bark oak? Willow?
Water.
Okay, good, good, excellent. And again, nuttle oak, I will tell you one thing about nuttle oak here, y'all, is that Jonathan McCurry, who's one of my students, found that nuttle oak is very water tolerant, okay? It's not as water tolerant as overcup oak, but it can withstand longer durations of flooding than willow oak and cherry bark oak. So I want to just say, you know, forget nuttle oak, but down at the lower elevation sites that may hold water longer, you may consider nuttle oak because it has very good timber value. It has a high timber value, and its acorns, the larger acorns, definitely are eaten by other wildlife, and occasionally, you know, a mallard or something will scarf one down. But I just mentioned that because at the lower elevations of a GTR, even that the hydrologic stress you get at those lower contours, you may have a hard time getting good survival of cherry bark and willow oak. And you can help with that survival by planting seedlings. What else? These also are important, can be managed as hunting sites. You know, you have to think about how you're going to manage an area. And a lot of the sites, you know, in Tennessee are scramble areas. In other words, they're just open and you can just go out there and go to an area. And they could function as those areas that's a great place to go and put your decoys out, etc. But you can also, if you have more regulated hunting and you have like a drawing system, these can be blinds, basically, where this is blind number one, blind number two, blind number three for each of your openings. And you can, by that approach, you can create generally a more high-quality hunting opportunity for folks because you space people out. And, you know, it's amazing that, you know, everybody always seems like they want to go to the same spot. You know, they all want to go to the one opening or two openings or whatever. And a lot of times that's because it may have like the best food resources around. That's where the birds like. And if you let them do that, they will do that usually. You'll have four people around a 1 acre little hole, you know, trying to slaughter everything that comes in, and nobody's having a good hunting experience. So by regulating access, I guess is what I'm saying, is that maybe doing a draw type system and having these numbered, you can provide a better hunting opportunity. There are some WMAs that are going to that, like Pagoda is right now, they're doing that. They have assigned areas and you put in for a draw, and the whole idea is a quality hunting experience. Although it's hard to get drawn, I've put my name in for 2 years and I know the manager, and his son is one of my grad students. I still can't get drawn, but anyways, all right. Yeah, so hunting opportunity. Actually, you can see the shell right there. There's a mallard right there, a Drake mallard. And this was a really neat, Noxubee did not allow hunting for a very long time. Although it was written in as one of the uses of the refuge, it never was allowed. In the 90s, Kaminsky got them to allow a youth hunt. And basically, he would have folks volunteer to take kids out along with their parents. But he wanted the refuge staff wanted it regulated. They wanted some representative there with the folks. So we would go out and we would guide for youths. And actually, this is a kid here that I took out, and man, we slaughtered him, or he slaughtered him, I should say. Missed a lot too, but it was a lot of fun. We had a great time. Anyways, so again, just to kind of summarize here, these openings are, you can use natural openings, or you can go in there and do small clear cuts, or you can do selective cuts. Again, the smaller that opening, you're going to have different birds using it, and a lot of your bigger dabbling ducks like mallards and stuff, they won't be able to fly in there. Now, where else do you put, I guess that's what I was going for with possible locations, where else do you put these openings? All right, where there's already some natural openings, you can open them wider. Where there are undesirable tree species. So if you go through there, you do a timber cruise, and you're getting maybe a bunch of overcup oak in an area or something that you don't want, something that's not even mass producing, this is where I'm going to go in and do an oak regeneration site and go in there and remove those undesirables and do some oak regeneration. Again, hunting zones, you may put them so they're spaced out nice so that you provide a more quality hunting experience. And all of these sites could be used as oak regeneration sites. And if you don't use them for oak regeneration sites, I strongly recommend that you manage for moist soil. So all you have to do is just manage the hydrology. It always gets an early drawdown here, you know, because you can't hold the water late. You know, you want, but you'll still get moist soil production. As long as you disc it every couple years, you'll keep all the woody, the natural woody regeneration from coming in. So. You can even go in those areas if you want, if it dries out enough, and you know, plant some type of hot crop like for example the agricultural variety of barnyard grass. What were the ones that we talked about? Japanese millet or pearl millet, brown top millet, are all ones you could plant in there if you so wanted to. That'll really get the birds coming in. Okay, so. This all works in concert, you know, your hydrology stuff we talked about a lot, but it works in concert with timber management objectives. Those objectives you may have, you may be in charge of, or a forester may be in charge of if you're on a larger WMA or refuge. But you work together, or by yourself through your own knowledge, through the forestry classes you take here and personal experience to meet those objectives. Because, you know, there's no reason in going into areas and not making money either. So you might as well go ahead and make some dollars in creating these openings. Any questions on that? Good stuff? So this is, after Mississippi, I went to Puerto Rico for about 2.5 years. And I worked in these systems. And this is what our cypress sloughs used to look like, man, y'all. There are still, and Puerto Rico is about one of the most developed island entities in the Caribbean, but there are still some remnant, quote unquote, what would be called cypress sloughs. Now, this species here is it's Pterocarpus is the genus, and it's called swamp bloodwood, because if you actually take a machete and you hit the bark, it has a red sap and it looks like blood. But now that is a massive tree, y'all. And I mean, I don't even know what the DBH would be up. I mean, you'd have to get up there to get above the buttress swelling, but it's huge. And I put that there because the next thing that I'm going to share with y'all is impoundment construction, which was the other reason I was down in Puerto Rico. I was doing an overall just biological census of the area. Upland areas as well as wetland areas like this massive Pterocarpus forest. I also ended up building some moist soil impoundments for them. And so I'll share those experiences with you. So yeah, that's an awesome system. Man, leeches everywhere. You come out, you got leeches all over you and tarantulas and scorpions. There aren't any poisonous snakes in Puerto Rico yet, but so you don't have that. And there aren't any large reptiles like gators or caimans yet, so you don't have to worry about that. But oh, there's lots of quicksand in that area. You have to be careful about. Yeah. I took out several undergrads from University of Puerto Rico with me, and several of them broke down by the time we got back. I mean, emotionally broke down going into that system. It's a really tough system to work in. It's, you're walking, you can see we're soaked. We're walking in water up to our waist. And it's, but it was fun. All right, that was 96, all right. We're here 10 years later, and I am still trying to get dialed. I still want to go back and take a grad student down there and study these systems. Nobody has studied the Pterocarpus forest in Puerto Rico. And this is actually a relatively common forest type throughout the subtropic areas, not only in the islands of the Caribbean, but also in Mexico and down into Central America and also other parts of the world. But they're very awesome systems. Okay, so that is that. So let's take a 5 minute, well, probably be a 10 minute break, and then I'll get things going here because I have to set up a slide projector.